Okay, well, so I guess I'll get started again. So I left off by defining this class MA, which is basically just a sort of a probabilistic version of NP, where this verification is done by a probabilistic algorithm, and we require that it has this sort of bounded error condition. The letters MA stand for Merlin Arthur. This is an example of a class that fits into this framework of Arthur Merlin games, which was defined by Laszlo Babay in the mid-80s. So that's where the name comes from. You don't really need to worry about the name. A lot of these classes actually have these sort of funny names that is two letters that you have no idea what they actually mean. Usually doesn't really matter. But if you want to know, that's why this is called MA. It stands for Merlin Arthur. Because you think of Merlin as being the person that supplies this proof, this thing Y that's supposed to convince Arthur, who's this verification procedure, that he's supposed to do a certain thing. So Arthur is trustworthy, but he's mortal. He's just a polynomial time computation. He's got a coin to flip. Merlin is very powerful, and he knows the right answer to everything, but he's just not trustworthy. So, you know, Arthur has to sort of impose these conditions here, because he doesn't want to be convinced by Merlin that he's supposed to do something when it's not the right thing to do. Here was the diagram of all of these classes. So I want to just point out that there's no known relationship between NP and BQP. They're conjectured to be incomparable. There should be problems that are solvable here, but they're not in NP, and there should be problems here that are not solvable here. But of course, we can't prove that. We can't prove that this and this are different, so the whole thing just might collapse to a point. But that's what's conjectured. In particular, over here, inside of NP are the so-called NP-complete problems. And this is a huge class of problems. It's very important. That represent, in some sense, the hardest problems in NP. A lot of combinatorial search types of problems that are of interest practically are there. And we just wish that we had good algorithms for those, but we don't. Nobody thinks that those problems are solvable with a quantum computer. But we can't prove that they aren't. The best evidence that we have to suggest that NP-complete problems are not solvable in polynomial time with a quantum computer is lower bound for search, that Grover's algorithm is optimal. That's not a very good evidence, and it would be nice to have some better evidence, but we just don't have that. Okay, so now let me define QMA. So it stands for Quantum Merlin Arthur, which is a quantum analog of the class NP, or really a quantum version of the class MA, but you can think of it as a quantum version of NP. So we can do this by changing the definition of NP in two ways. First, we're going to allow this verification procedure to be a quantum computation. That's quite natural. And moreover, we're going to allow this proof, or this certificate, or whatever you think of it, the thing that I called Y, the string Y from the previous slides. Now we're going to let that thing be a quantum state. It doesn't have to be just a classical string anymore. And if we do that, then we define class QMA in the following way. It's almost exactly the same here as NP and MA, so I don't want to spend too much time going through it all. It's just the same ideas, but you see the differences. Here, this is a family of quantum circuits. In the completeness case, whenever the input is a yes input, then there must exist a quantum state, rho, on a polynomial number of qubits, such that if you plug this quantum state into your computation along with the string x, then the thing is going to say 1 or yes, I believe you with probability at least 2/3. And something analogous for the soundness condition. So in this case, we have quantum circuits, and they're taking as input two things. One is the input x, and the other thing is a quantum state coming in as an input that's supposed to convince this verification procedure that the answer is yes. Now, it holds that this probability 2/3, just as we had for the case of BPP and BQP, can be replaced by some different choice of a constant, or in fact even something exponentially close to 1 if you prefer. And this can even be done without changing the length of the quantum proof. And that's not so easy to see, but it is true. So let me just say more precisely what I mean. Suppose that you have some problem and it's in QMA. It satisfies the definitions from the previous slide where you have this probability 2/3. You would like to increase this 2/3, make it bigger, because you want to have more confidence. So it holds that you can do this, and you can do this without increasing the size of this quantum proof. So here, this P represented the size or the length of the quantum proof, and down here it's going to be the same. So what this is saying is that you choose whatever polynomial Q that you want. It's possible to come up with a new family of quantum circuits that have the following properties, which are much stronger versions of these. So if you have a yes input, you run your circuit R, your algorithm R, on the input X, along with some particular state rho. So this is just asserting the existence of some state rho that you can put in here. This thing is going to say, yes, I believe the proof, and it's going to do this with a very high probability, almost 1, exponentially close to 1. And if you have a no input, you plug this thing, plug this input X into your verification procedure along with any possible state rho that you could come up with to put in there. The thing is going to say, no, I don't believe it. It's not a valid proof. And it's going to do that with very, very high probability as well. So in this way, you can increase your confidence of being correct. And you can even do this without increasing the size of the proof. And that's kind of important, actually, for proving things about this class, that if you want, you can take this polynomial here, Q, to be much, much larger than P. So your probability of error can be much, much smaller than the reciprocal of the dimension of the space that the proofs live in. That's actually quite helpful for proving things about this class. I don't really want to tell you exactly how that works. I'll show you the circuit diagram for doing it. It involves sort of running the verification procedure forward and backward and making measurements in between and calculating things. A little bit like Grover's algorithm. Did you hear about Grover's algorithm yesterday? It kind of works in a similar type of way, although specifics are a little bit different. I don't expect you to stare at this thing and say, oh, yes, I see how it works. But I just want to convince you that I'm not lying. So now here's our diagram of classes. So we ask, where does QMA sit? Well, certainly it contains BQP, trivially, because if you want, you can just ignore the proof. Just run an ordinary polynomial time quantum computation. And it contains MA because the proof can be quantum. You can also handle a classical proof as well and just let your verification be classical. You don't have to make use of your quantum power. And if a verifier is behaving classically, it doesn't matter if the proof is quantum. As soon as the verifier touches it, it may as well just be measured and it acts classically. So a prover or Merlin, he can't sort of get any advantage of using quantum proof for a classical Arthur. Doesn't help. And that's not what I said. I said if the verification is classical and the proof is quantum, then the proof may as well be classical, because as soon as a classical person touches a quantum state, it just collapses to a classical. Yeah, so if you have a quantum circuit and a classical proof, that's a different class. Sometimes it's called QCMA. And it's not, you know, that's sort of in between MA and QMA. It's not known to be more powerful, but it, you know, probably is. It contains BQP, and MA seemingly doesn't. But, you know, of course, it's same as always. We can't prove these things, but we think. Okay, again, this class QMA is contained in PP. Sort of shows you the power of this class. It's a very huge class of problems. You know, again, I can't really show you that because I don't have time, but if you remember, I told you that about this two proofs of BQP contained in PP. If you look at the second definition where you think about PP computations as somehow being able to perform exponential size matrix multiplications in a certain sort of abstract way, you can extend that proof to show that actually QMA is contained in PP. I think you're going to have to just take my word for that. I haven't prepared any slides on it, and it's a bit technical, but it's possible to prove that. There's several problems that are known to be in QMA that are of interest. Matt Hastings is going to speak tonight about an area sometimes called Hamiltonian complexity and some problems that are well characterized by this notion of QMA. So I'm not going to spend too much time on it. If you go to the talk tonight, you'll see those things. I want to mention just one that's a particularly well-known example. And this is a so-called two-local Hamiltonian problem. So the input to this problem is a description of a Hamiltonian, which, if you don't know what a Hamiltonian is, it's just a Hermitian matrix on n qubits. And we require that this thing is two-local. So essentially what that means is that you could describe this thing by a quantum circuit where you had gates acting on just two qubits at a time. Although it doesn't really have to be a quantum circuit, you could sort of substitute just arbitrary matrices for these gates, and that's essentially what it means. so think of it as an efficiently describable Hamiltonian. It's on a number of n of qubits. The matrix itself is exponential size, but you have some succinct description of that Hamiltonian. And you're interested in the lowest possible energy state of that Hamiltonian. So you want to know, let's say in the S case, does there exist a quantum state? So that if you look at this expression here, which I guess you can sort of think about as the energy associated with this state, it's smaller than some number A, which is part of the input to the problem. And in the no case, every possible state you give will give this value that's larger than B, and you just require that A and B are not too close together. They're separated by a big enough distance that it's possible in some way to distinguish them. So this is an example of a QMA complete problem, sort of representative of the hardest possible problem you can have in QMA. And there's a sort of growing class of problems that are like this that are motivated by physical models and so on. And I guess a computer scientist's way of thinking about this is that it's sort of a quantum analog of the Cook-Levin theorem, which tells you that satisfiability is NP-complete, which is kind of like the first NP-complete problem that you usually work with and then branch off from there. Question? Rational? Oh, it doesn't really matter. I just need them to be things that you can represent in a computer. If you want to have them be irrational, you can, but as long as you have a way of writing them as bits, that's all I care about. I mean, there's nothing important about them being rationals, but that's just, you know, the typical way of defining the problem. If it's a computational problem, you work with rational numbers. If you want, you can work with algebraic numbers, and then you have some complicated way of expressing what is an algebraic number. You can work with a larger set if you want, but it doesn't have anything to do with this problem, so just assume it's rational. They should be real. It has to be real to make sense. Okay, so I won't say very much about that because I'm under the impression that Matt will say quite a lot about this type of problem tonight, so you should see a lot more details on this kind of thing. I want to mention a different example that shows possibly the power of a quantum proof, an advantage that a quantum proof can have over a classical proof. And that deals with a type of group theoretic problem. You don't need to know what a finite group is, necessarily. If you do, it helps. And if you don't, every time I write finite group, you can think of matrices over a finite field, something like that. Things that you can multiply together, but it's not necessarily commutative, and is a finite set in total. Groups of symmetries or something like that. So let's imagine we have a finite group, and imagine that we have some way of writing down the elements in this group as strings of length n for some n. And let's imagine that it's a nice enough group that this representation is actually unique. You have one way of writing down each element. You can tell two elements apart by looking at the strings that represent them, which is not a huge requirement, but for example, working with factor groups wouldn't fall into this category. And now let's assume, moreover, that we have some efficient way of performing the group operations. If I give you two elements in this group, you can multiply them together. you can do this sort of computation here. I've written it here as a unitary computation or a reversible computation because that's sort of convenient to have for this setting where we're working with quantum computations. But the point is, if I give you G and H, you can multiply them together. For example, if they're matrices over a finite field, you just do matrix multiplication, and that's this multiplication operation. You can also compute inverses. So just assume that you have these things. Sometimes it's helpful to think about groups like this, where I just make these requirements, and I don't really tell you very much about the specifics of the group. You think of these as black box groups. It's like, I haven't really worried about the specifics. It could be matrices over a finite field. It could be permutation groups. It could be just about any other kind of group you can think of. But we don't need it to be anything specific, so we just let it be as general as possible. So here's an example of a problem in this setting, group membership problem. Maybe it should be called the subgroup membership problem. So let's imagine that the input is a collection of elements in some group G. G is sort of the group that we're working in. You can think of it as like the supergroup. It's like the complete set of all of the things you're working with, all the matrices over of a certain dimension of our finite field. So you're given G1 and through GK, and you think of G1 and through GK as generating some group, all the possible ways you can multiply those things together. It's a collection of objects as a subgroup. And you're also given some H. And the question is, you know, whether or not H is in that group. Can it be generated from G1 through GK? So the yes inputs are going to be those H's that can be generated by G1 through GK. So this notation here, these angled brackets, it just means the set of all the things that you could get by multiplying these guys together in any order you like, taking any number of copies of each one. And the no case is when H is not an element. So this problem is in NP. If I have a bunch of elements in a group here, and I have some other element, and I want to convince you that it's possible to get this guy by taking these guys in any number, in any combination, multiplying them together to get H, I can convince you of that, and I can do that efficiently. It's not as easy as you think, though. You can't just write down a list of the elements that you multiply together in the order you multiply them, because there might be an exponential number. For example, think about the integers mod p for some large prime p. That's generated by the element 1, which I just add to itself lots and lots of times. But I can't just sort of tell you some element is in this group by showing you, say, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 exponential number of times. But what you can do is you can give what's called a straight line program, a program with no loops, which just multiplies together things and takes inverses and so on. It's always possible to efficiently generate H from G1 through GK by taking a straight line program like this. You can do repeated squaring and this kind of thing. It's a consequence of something called the reachability lemma, Babai and Zemeretti. On the other hand, group non-membership, if I switch around the S's and the O's, it's not known to be in MA. It's kind of along similar lines to the graph isomorphism example I told you before. If you want to convince somebody that H cannot be generated by G1 through GK, then nobody knows how to do that efficiently, for maybe similar reasons as we had with graph isomorphism. It's hard to convince somebody that something is not possible. But it is possible to do this in QMA. So this gives you an example where a quantum proof can do something that we don't know how to do with a classical proof. So what I want to try to convince you of is that group non-membership is in QMA. So if I have a particular group, and I have these elements G1 through GK and some element H, and I want to convince you that H cannot be generated by G1 through GK, then I can do that efficiently. I can give you a quantum state that will convince you that that's so, and you check that state with your quantum computer, and you'll be convinced. So is the problem unclear? Or I can't ask you if the problem is clear, right? Because you can't answer for everybody. Only people for which it's unclear can answer the question. If anyone would like to understand the problem and doesn't, now's the time to ask. Maybe as we go along, it'll help. So the idea is very, very simple. So let's let H be the subgroup that's generated by G1 through GK. And we're trying to prove to somebody that H is not contained in H. And we want to do that by giving them a quantum state, and they're going to check that state with their computer, quantum computer. What we're going to do is we're going to just give them a uniform superposition over all of the elements of H. And that's going to be enough. So it's actually independent of this H. Same proof would work for every possible H. But that's going to be good enough. Now, it might actually be very, very hard to construct this state. If I give you G1 through GK and I ask you to construct this state here, nobody knows an efficient way to do that. It would be nice if we could do that. Maybe we can. And we can do it for some groups. We can do it for abelian groups. We can do it for solvable groups. But for general groups, we don't know how to do it. Now, let's just suppose for the moment that somebody actually gave you this set, this state, and you really believed it. So in general, we can't necessarily believe it. We have to worry about Merlin, who's being devious and trying to convince Arthur of something that's not true. But let's just forget about that for a moment and imagine that we really had this H. If we had that H, it would be quite easy to test membership. And we could do it with a circuit that looks like this. That circuit actually looks kind of similar to examples you probably saw yesterday. This is kind of an example of phase estimation or eigenvalue estimation. But you don't really need to think about it that way. You can think about it in simpler terms. So we have a circuit here, and I have to tell you, I guess, what this means. So this M sub H here means multiply by H. You take an input over here, and whatever that is, you just sort of multiply H into that, say on the left-hand side. And that's some unitary computation. You can do this efficiently if you have access to these group operations. And it's controlled by this one qubit up here. So we take a zero, we plug it into this qubit up here, we do a Hadamard transform on it. So at this point, we have a superposition between zero and one. And so it's kind of like in superposition, we either do this or we don't. And then we do another Hadamard transform and measure. So let's first imagine that H, little h, was really an element of H. And we ran this computation. So what would happen? We start with a zero here, we do the Hadamard transform. We do this controlled multiply by H operation. But in the zero case, okay, so in the zero case, nothing happens because it's controlled by this qubit. Nothing happens. That's the definition. In the one case, we multiply by little h. So that just multiplies h into this thing here. But that's just h because this is invariant under multiplication of elements in that subgroup. This is sort of stirring them around, but this thing was already stirred. So nothing happened. So in both cases, nothing happened. It's almost like this gate was never even there. So you had a zero, you did a Hadamard transform, you did nothing at all, you did another Hadamard transform, and you measure. You're going to see zero, because Hadamard transform is its own inverse. On the other hand, if H is not in H, then multiplying by H is going to take you to some coset that's orthogonal, in fact. There's going to be no overlap between these elements and these elements here. So this is almost acting like a measurement. It's going to leave over here. If you were smart enough and you could look at that and you could solve the problem for yourself, you could tell whether or not this thing was a zero or a one. It doesn't matter that you're actually smart enough to do that. None of us are, apparently. But information, theoretically, the information is there, and that's all that matters. So it's almost like a measurement happened here. So you had a zero, you did a Hadamard transform, you did a measurement, so it's kind of like a completely mixed state right here. You do another Hadamard transform and just leaves the mixed state alone. And you measure. Well, you'll have a 50% chance of seeing a zero versus a one. So you get a uniform bit. And that's good enough to tell you whether that H was not an element of big H, with at least some probability. And if you imagine sort of repeating this a couple of times, you could instead have asked for several copies of H instead of just one. Or if you want, you could do something a little bit more clever and use just one copy. You can be convinced that little h is not an element of H. There might be a small probability you make an error, but that's okay, because that's allowed in our definition. There's a problem, of course, which is you can't trust the proof, right? That might not be the quantum state that you were given, and you have to worry about that. So imagine that Merlin was being devious. He's trying to make Arthur say not an element, and maybe he's trying to do that and it really was an element. H really was an element of H. So he gives Arthur some quantum state here, and who can possibly say what the behavior will be? It could be anything. If Merlin wants, and he knows enough about this group, he could give a state here that would make this be one with probability one. If he's being dishonest. So here's the solution to the problem. You get this thing here, it's supposed to be this uniform superposition over H, but it may not be. So don't run the membership test for H from the previous slide. Instead, run the following test, and each time you do it, some reasonably large number of times, polynomial number of times, and each time you do it, pick a random element of H. The thing better tell you zero, because you know that these things are chosen from H. That's the way you'll choose them. You have to be careful about the way you choose them. You want to choose them uniformly enough so that they'll have some nice properties. But let's just imagine you take them to be random. It's enough for the purposes of this talk to say they're just random. If any of those tests would ever output one up here, then you know that Merlin was cheating and gave you a bad proof, because the thing should always tell you zero. That was something we had from the previous slide. You should get a zero when H is contained in H. So you just reject right away and say, I don't believe your proof. Otherwise, you just keep doing this and, you know, keep doing it on the same proof every time. So, you know, something comes out over here and you just take that and you plug that into the next one. Each time you just take a new random element of H and you just keep on using the same proof over and over, plugging in the next one, the next one, the next one. And we can ask what happens. So imagine that we do this. We had some state, we don't really know what it is. We ran this membership test. We ran it on A, some A which was random in H of our choice, instead of using this given H. Well, we know already that if we ever see a 1, we just reject right away. It must be a bad proof. So let's condition on seeing a 0 and ask ourselves what we have there. Well, if you do the analysis, you see that you have this thing. It's going to be a linear combination of the original thing, which kind of corresponds to having done nothing up here, plus something where you did this multiplication that sort of corresponds to when there was a 1 up here. And I didn't normalize this thing. Of course, you have to normalize that thing. But the point is, it's a linear combination of those two possibilities. Now imagine I just kept on doing this over and over and over again, each time with a random choice of A. And every single time it said 0. I'm going to be left with something that looks like this at the end of the day. If I chose these guys well enough, I'm going to get something that looks like just a uniform sum over every single possible element in that set H. So technically, if you wanted to do this, you should choose this A1 through AK to be so-called cube generators of this group, so that if you sort of line them up and you put zeros and ones in the exponents, you would get something at the end of the day which was very, very close to being uniform over the entire group. And it's known how to find those things probabilistically, classically. So now once you've done this, this state's now ready to be used for your membership test with H. It might not actually be a uniform superposition over the subgroup H. That's fine. The point is that it is very, very close to being invariant under multiplication by elements in H. So if you took your H and this little h was not contained in the subgroup H, then this thing would not be invariant and you would have a good probability of seeing a 1. But if it was the case that Merlin was lying, this thing is very, very close to being invariant under multiplication by H, and so you'll get the same behavior from the previous slide. Question? No, he could give you mixed states. So here on this slide, I'm assuming, just to write them more clearly, that they're pure states. The behavior for mixed states is going to be a convex combination of the behavior for pure states. So if you have some guarantee on the maximum probability that Arthur accepts for pure states, then you sort of just immediately get it for mixed states by convexity. So it could be the case that a mixed state is given, but the analysis would be the same. Just first do the analysis for pure states, and you conclude from that what happens for mixed states. So that's the end of that. That's an example of how a quantum proof could potentially be advantageous over a classical proof. Going back to this graph isomorphism problem, this graph non-isomorphism problem, It's a really nice question to ask. Can you give a quantum proof that two graphs are not isomorphic? And that's a big open question. Nobody knows how to do that. And if you can do that, then that's a great result. Many people have tried. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about something a bit different, a sort of generalization of... Oh, you have a question before. Oh, it's not known to be QMA complete. That's right. And it's probably not QMA complete. And the reason is that actually this problem is kind of special in a way for all these problems we know to be in QMA, because you can phrase it as a language as opposed to being a promise problem. You can have, I mean, you can phrase this problem so that the yeses and the nos exhaust all the possibilities. There are no care inputs. And probably QMA doesn't have any complete problems for which that's true. Again, same thing as always, we can't prove it. But one would reasonably guess that you couldn't have a QMA complete problem that was a language. But it's just a conjecture. There's also some evidence to suggest that you could give a classical proof that you would check with a quantum computer for group non-membership as well, using much more complicated facts about group theory, computational group theory. But that's not proved. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about an extension of these notions called interactive proof systems. So this notion of efficient verification, this definition of NP, MA, QMA, and so on, you can generalize these to a setting where you have an interaction between somebody who's verifying something and somebody who's proving it. So to define these things, we kind of imagine two people, and we call them the verifier and the prover. You can call them Arthur and Merlin, kind of, again, examples of the setting of Arthur and Merlin games. And this verifier, or Arthur, he's always a polynomial time computation. He's a normal person running an algorithm. Always give this verifier randomness, or quantum computing power in the case of the quantum model. And the reason we do that is because the model just turns out not to be interesting if we don't. This prover here is unrestricted. Prover can compute difficult to compute functions. If it's quantum, it can do difficult quantum computations. Of course, we require that the prover obeys the laws of physics. That's not in question. But we don't place computational assumptions on the prover. So it's kind of just like we had for NP, where we didn't care about how long it takes to come up with these proofs. We're not going to care about the resources that this person over here needs. But they exist in the physical world. They have to obey the laws of physics, of course. So the way the model works is that they're both going to receive some input string X, and they're going to have a conversation about it. And then once that conversation is done, the verifier is going to make a decision. Either output 0 or 1. And you think of 1 as being accept, or I believe you, I believe your proof. And 0 is no, I don't believe your proof. The way we can think about this is that the prover's goal here is to convince the verifier to output 1. He's trying to convince the verifier that some input is a yes input to some problem. That's his motivation. The verifier just wants to know the truth. He's running an algorithm to just verify the prover's claim. So we say that a problem has an interactive proof system if we have the description of some verifier and it satisfies two conditions. And this is almost the same conditions that we had in the case of NP, MA, and so on. It's completeness and soundness conditions. The only difference here is that it's interactive. Messages go back and forth between the two. So if it's the case that you have a yes input to this problem, then there must exist some prover that will convince V to the verifier to say, I believe you. The input is a yes input. Soundness case means that it doesn't matter what the prover does, no matter how devious the prover is, he's not going to succeed in convincing the verifier to accept. And we assume that these things are with high probability and with low in both cases, the correct thing should happen with high probability. You can take 2/3 if you want, any other constant bigger than 1/2, smaller than 1. So now we define two complexity classes. There's lots of complexity classes you can define based on this notion, but in particular we have these two. First is AM, stands for Arthur Merlin. And this is the class of all the promise problems that have an interactive proof system like this. This is all classical at this point. And we restrict the number of messages that go back and forth between the prover and verifier to be some constant. So as the input size grows, the number of messages can grow. It has to be some fixed constant. It's just a restriction you're putting on these interactions for the sake of defining classes. So that class is called AM. And the class IP, which stands for interactive proof, is a class of all problems that have interactive proof systems like this, and you don't put that restriction on. You allow any number of messages to go back and forth between the prover and verifier. That number of messages can grow as the input size grows. It's got to be polynomial number in total because you assume that the verifier runs in polynomial time. So he doesn't have time to look at more than a polynomial number of messages anyway. So let me give you an informal example of how an interaction can be useful for proving something. So suppose I claim to you that Coke and Pepsi taste different. I don't know if they do. I mean, let's imagine, you know. Does anybody know, can anyone taste the difference? Does anyone think about these things anymore? Okay. I mean, there was a point at which this was relevant back in maybe the 80s or so, when there was a big issue about the difference. I guess I haven't followed the discussion since then. But anyway, let's suppose you make this claim, and let's suppose that you can taste the difference. How do you convince somebody? And by the way, if you can't, you can always just substitute salt and sugar for this example. I think everybody can taste the difference between salt and sugar. So, how would you convince somebody? Well, imagine that you wanted a non-interactive proof, a proof that's kind of analogous to an NP type of proof. You're going to write down some string, give it to somebody, they're going to look at it, they're going to verify it, and they're going to be convinced that Coke and Pepsi taste different. That's impossible. I claim it's impossible. You can't get the formula for Coke in particular, right? Probably none of us know enough biochemistry or whatever it is that you would need to verify a proof or come up with a proof that Coke and Pepsi taste different. I don't even know exactly what it means, but hopefully you get the idea. But with an interactive proof, if there's an interaction, it's very, very easy, right? You just let this skeptic run a blind taste test on you. You put a blindfold on. The skeptic gives you one of the two beverages at random. You taste it. You tell him it's Coke. You repeat this 100 times. Every single time, you're right. At the end of this experiment, if you're right every time, I think the skeptic should probably believe you that Coke and Pepsi taste different. You've succeeded in convincing them every single time, getting the right answer. It could be that you were just very, very lucky. But, flipping a coin 100 times and getting heads every single time is not very likely. We have to accept the small probability that, it was just a freak thing that this was correct. But, that's just part of the model. We allow the small error. On the other hand, if Coke and Pepsi really do taste the same, there's no way that you're going to succeed with this. I mean, you're randomly guessing. The skeptic should definitely believe you. So that's an example of an interactive proof. Of course, it's not a computational problem. It's just a fixed problem. But maybe you get the idea. Do you have a question? Well, you could run this test in parallel. You could run it 100 times in parallel. The messages can be very, very long. It could be, I'm just going to randomly choose, and I'm going to have 100 glasses, and I'm going to give you all of them at once, and then you sort of going to respond all at once. So when we're talking about the number of messages, it's not the number of bits or anything like that. It's just the number of actual rounds of communication. So this would work just fine, two rounds, or two messages, one round, however you want to count the rounds. So there's a similar protocol for graph non-isomorphism. So from before, we know, we don't know, that graph isomorphism is in NP. But there is a very simple way that a prover can convince a verifier that two graphs are not isomorphic. Same idea. It's a blind taste test. starts by the verifier first randomly choosing one of the two graphs and then just mixing it up, choosing a random permutation, applying that permutation to this random graph. It's either G0 or G1. The prover doesn't know which one it is, and the verifier sends that random mixed up graph to the prover. So of course, if the two graphs are isomorphic, there's absolutely no difference in the distribution you would get in these two cases, right? I mean, if you can get from one graph to another by applying a permutation, and you randomly choose a permutation to apply to either one of them and you output the answer, the distribution is the same in both cases. It's just uniform over all the possible graphs that are isomorphic to both of them. But if the two graphs are not isomorphic, these are disjoint distributions. So the verifier sends the graph to the prover, and the prover tastes it. And he can tell the difference. He can taste the difference between G0 and G1 because he's got all the computation power he wants. He just solves the isomorphism problem for the given graph, and he knows which one it is. So he answers with the correct answer. But of course, if the graphs were isomorphic, then he can't possibly tell the difference because the two distributions were identical. So he has to just randomly guess, and it's not very likely he's going to succeed in random guessing. If we repeat this 100 times, it's not very likely that he would guess right every time. So that's how a prover can convince a verifier that two graphs are not isomorphic through an interaction. So does that make sense? Sometimes I see like a lowering of eyebrows, and I usually interpret that as meaning like, what are you talking about? Happy to help to. Okay. This particular protocol that I just described has a probability of error of 1/2 in one of the cases. Sort of like you have a probability 1 in one case and 1/2 in the other. And you may not like that. It doesn't exactly fit the definition I gave you from before. But just repeat the process 10 times and take the majority vote or something like that. Or actually, in this case, you just make sure the prover is right every time. And you'll reduce these probability of errors very quickly. So here's the diagram now. It's getting bigger. Here's this class AM. Well, it contains MA because an MA protocol is just a special type of interactive protocol where there just doesn't happen to be any messages that go from the verifier back to the prover. Just one message from the prover to the verifier. It's a special case. Here's this class IP, where you allow some polynomial number of messages to go back and forth. And it turns out that that's equal to p-space. And that was a huge result from 1990 that finally resolved a question that had been kicking around for, well, it wasn't that long, actually, 5 years or so, of what the power of this class was. But it happens to coincide exactly with p-space. And that's not easy to see. If I give you any problem in p-space, some p-space complete problem, or in other words, a problem that's kind of like the hardest possible problem you can have in p-space, and I want to give you some interactive protocol for that, that would convince some polynomial time verifier when the input was a yes input, well, you have to do something very non-trivial. You sort of reduce it to some quantified Boolean formula problem. You take that Boolean formula, you sort of represent it as a kind of a polynomial over a finite field of a large enough size where you think of zeros and ones as being the binary values. And there's some kind of random thing that goes back and forth involving interpolation of polynomials and simplifications and choosing random points and so on. And at the end of the day, it works. So it's highly non-trivial. But you can find it in textbooks on complexity. And it's not known if a constant number of rounds of communication or constant number of messages back and forth is enough to do that. Most people conjecture that it is not. So apparently AM is not as big as IP, but we don't know. It's not known that AM is contained in PP or not. It's believed that these two are incomparable. It's not known that QMA is contained in AM or even BQP. But it could be. I mean, it could be that BQP is contained in AM. That's possible. There actually isn't very good evidence either way. So think of that as an open problem. So on occasion, people ask what the motivation for thinking about these things is. Of course, you can't implement a prover if you want to solve a particular problem. I mean, you're allowing this prover to compute difficult functions. You can't build this thing, and nobody claims that you can build this thing. So I wanted to give you a little bit of motivation for why we might think about these things. I think that the real answer is, my real answer is that we think about these things because they're interesting. And as theorists, I mean, that's all we have in a way, right? We have to think about what are the fundamental questions, and we have to just try to answer them. In a way, I mean, this is kind of where theory of computation comes from, right? It comes from the study of logic, the notion of proof. A long time ago, people like, Hilbert, Gödel, Bertrand Russell, of course, Alan Turing, they were all interested in questions that had a lot to do with verification of proofs. Because at some point, you know, the proof of a mathematical theorem and the verification of a proof is a computational process. You're just moving symbols around, right? You check the validity of a proof. Imagine you wrote down a proof of some fact and you reduced it to, Zermelo-Frankel set theory with axiom of choice or something like that. It's all just symbols. You can verify this proof, and, you know, essentially that's a computation, and the connection between these things was understood early on before there existed computers. That had a lot to do with where our field basically comes from. And of course, this notion of efficient verification of proofs and the connection with NP is very important. I mean, there's no question about this. The notion, the theory of NP completeness is enormously important. If you go to Google Scholar and you search for NP complete, you will get thousands and thousands and thousands of hits. You'll get hits in fields including geology, biology, astronomy, surely physics. Every field has their NP complete problems. It's the greatest export of complexity theory that there is. And these things were extended to this interactive setting. This was motivated partly by cryptography, where you think of proofs in a cryptographic context. But it turned out that actually this study of these abstract interactive proofs, which are, you know, not obviously necessarily well motivated, turned out to tell us something really important. And so that's what this example is all about. So I mentioned this theory of NP completeness. This is coming from the early 70s. And soon after that, people devised this notion of an approximation problem. Like, well, if I can't solve my NP complete problem efficiently, you know, that's unfortunate, but the problem doesn't go away. I still need to solve it. So maybe I'll be happy to have some approximate version. Maybe I don't need the optimal solution. I just need one that's pretty good. How hard is that problem? So that's this notion of an approximation problem, and people came up with approximation algorithms, efficient algorithms, for getting reasonably good approximations to some of these problems, and for others they couldn't do it. But nobody could prove that, you know, a large class of these problems was really hard. So this was a big riddle that was around for a long time. How do you prove the hardness of an approximation problem? You'd like to have some notion of saying, well, okay, this problem is NP complete. But it's an approximate version of an NP-complete problem that can be very difficult. So independently, people came up with this notion of interactive proof systems. This was mid-80s. And there's lots of generalizations of this notion of multi-prover interactive proofs. We have, say, two provers or some large number of provers. You require that they can't talk to each other once the interaction starts. It turns out to be a very powerful restriction you can place on provers. It's kind of like suspects in a police station. You know, they're being interrogated by a detective and they can't talk to each other. So a detective can often get to the bottom of the story by comparing their answers with each other. They can't correlate their answers. Well, the study of interactive proofs, which of course it's important for this example that none of this had anything to do with approximation problems, led to this result that I mentioned before, IP equals P space. This result in turn led to this result, MIP equals NEXP. So MIP stands for multi-prover interactive proofs. NEXP stands for non-deterministic exponential time. It's an enormously large class of problems. It's like a version of NP, but scaled up to an exponential. Turns out that these things are very, very powerful. So this arrow here, I believe it represents about 3 weeks. Once they had the proof here, they got the proof here in just a few weeks. And then this led to something that we call the PCP theorem. people took this result, which seemed really interesting, but it had to do with this huge class, and kind of scaled it down to NP. So here, this is about non-deterministic exponential time. They scaled it down to have something to do with NP, non-deterministic polynomial time. And then, finally, this theorem led to this breakthrough of how to understand approximation problems. The connection is not obvious, but it's there. And finally, this gave a way of proving that approximation problems are hard. And as a result of that, there's now a very sort of healthy interaction between these two, where people can sort of, you know, take turns proving, you know, getting new approximation algorithms and proving hardness results, and sometimes you can sort of just narrow these things down and get the right bounds. So this sort of circuitous route here through indirective proof systems led to this a solution to this problem, which is very, very practical. People need to solve approximation problems, and I think that that's a good piece of motivation. I should mention that Irit Dinur has come up with a combinatorial proof, so it is possible now to circumvent all this and just write down a proof of this PCP theorem. And the proof turns out to be much simpler. But of course, I mean, the proof took a long time to get this. And arguably, it never would have been done if the theorem hadn't been proved in the first place. You've got to know what to prove before you can prove it. Nevertheless, I think the motivation is still in place. Okay, so I'm starting to run out of time, but I think I'll have enough time to say something about quantum interactive proof systems. We can define a model that's in spirit exactly the same as the interactive proof system model, and all we do is we just change everybody to their quantum. The verifiers have got a quantum computer, the prover has a quantum computer, the verifier has to run in polynomial time, the prover doesn't, and these notions of completeness and soundness are exactly the same. If you want to formalize this model, you can do it through the use of quantum circuits. You think about a picture that looks something like this, where here on top is the verifier, and he's sort of divided into segments where he does some sort of computation. He sends some state to the prover, so this arrow here represents something being sent to the prover. The prover does something, maybe the prover has some memory of his own, sends something back to the verifier, and so on. They exchange a number of messages, and then finally at the end of the day, the verifier gives his output. Does he believe the proof or not? In this example, there's 6 messages, but you could have any number of messages. Should be a polynomial number at most. And you could put restrictions on this number of messages, just like we did in the classical case. So we can define some complexity classes in the natural way, based on this notion. So QIP is the class of all the problems that have interactive proof systems, the quantum interactive proof systems. Same as before, now it's quantum. We don't put any restriction on the number of messages going back and forth. As long as everything is polynomial, it's fine. We can also restrict the number of messages to be, say, some m. So you could take m to be constant, you could take it to be 2, 3, logarithmic, whatever you like. We'll just define some complexity class based on whatever restriction you like. So what we now know is that it turns out that 3 messages are actually enough to get everything, which is something different from the classical case. We don't know that AM and IP are different. We believe they are. In the quantum case, it turns out that a polynomial number of messages doesn't buy you anything over 3 messages. So you can always collapse it down to 3. In the classical case, I didn't mention if you have a constant number of messages, you can always collapse it down to 2. But if it's a polynomial number of messages, nobody knows how to collapse that down. But that's what happens in the quantum case. And it turns out that QIP is equal to p-space, and that's only been known for, well, I guess less than a month. So it turns out that quantum interactive proof systems aren't any more powerful than classical ones. They give you exactly the same collection of problems. But apparently they give you a significant savings in the number of messages that have to go back and forth. So here's the diagram now. QIP1 is just a fancy name for QMA. It's one message from the prover to the verifier. You always assume the prover sends the last message. There's no point to the verifier sending a message to the prover and then not asking for a response, because nobody cares what the prover thinks. QIP2 is a funny one. We don't really know very much about that. It sits, well, between QIP, which is QIP3, and QIP1. That's trivial. And of course, it contains AM, because I told you that AM, you can always collapse it down to two messages. So you can of course simulate two classical message interactive first systems with quantum ones. And that's the picture we have. I'll give you a quick application of this result, which deals with circuit distinguishability. So if we consider the following problem, then we can nail down its complexity exactly, which is sort of nice. So the problem is that I give you two quantum circuits described in a natural way. Assume you have some natural way of encoding quantum circuits. They both have the same number of input qubits and output qubits. And the question is, are they the same or are they different? Okay, as circuits, they might be different, but we're interested in whether or not they do the same thing. As mappings, are they equal or not? Or are they close to each other or are they far apart? So it's a promise problem, so let's assume that in the yes case, they're very different. So I'm going to say they're 1 minus epsilon distinguishable. And I haven't defined this notion formally, but informally it means that if you're smart enough, you can tell the difference between them. They act very, very differently for at least some setting of an input. And in the no case, they're epsilon indistinguishable. It doesn't matter how smart you are, you're not going to be able to tell the difference between those two things, except with a very small probability. You can take epsilon to be 1/1,000, say. So we can ask how difficult that problem is. And the answer is it's piece-based complete. And the way we know that is because this problem is very closely related to quantum interactive proof systems. And I'm not going to show you that, but maybe you can somehow, maybe you're willing to believe that when you look at a three-message quantum interactive proof system and you think about what the prover is doing and what the verifier is doing, there's a way of somehow defining some circuits, and it all boils down to their distinguishability, whether or not a prover can make this verifier accept versus reject. Sort of have to take it on faith, but it is possible. And now we know QIP equals piece-space, and from that we can conclude that this is a piece-space complete problem. So maybe that's one application of a quantum interactive proof system, that it allows us to sort of nail down the complexity of this problem, which I think is a pretty natural problem. You're just asking, I have two physical processes, are they the same or not? I think I'm all out of time, so I'm going to have to stop there. Maybe I'll just kind of flash back to the picture and leave it at that. So thanks for your attention.